Over 10 years ago, I became really, really ill with a somewhat rare autoimmune disease, on top of several I already had. This necessitated a 2-week hospital stay, during which my husband was absolutely overrun with compliments, help, meals sent or brought over, and on because he was taking care of his children and his household for 2 weeks. You know, the stuff I'd been doing day in, day out, 24/7, 365 for 15 years at this point. I guess I should have been grateful it didn't happen over the winter holidays because they would have been a complete shit show. At this point in the marriage, we'd been to couples counseling several times. The first one sent us home with copies of books to reflect on. The next two told me that I needed to meet his needs sexually more often. No one asked him to contribute to the household load more, and certainly no one ever asked if he met my sexual needs. Nope, it was be sure he gets laid more often. That will fix everything. So we scheduled sex once a week, on a calendar, no less. Keep in mind, due to the thing I was hospitalized for, I was on chemotherapy during this whole lovely tale and had maintenance drugs and infusions right to this day. A few months later, he had to go to the hospital for back pain, which turned out to be cancer. I kept all the balls in the air, including his appointments, surgeries, etc. I also kept trying to keep our sex schedule, and here's the kicker. The shingles was mostly on my back. I was dead tired from stress, 4 young children, the health issues, the money issues, and on. And I started crying during sex because it hurt, all of it. And he did stop and ask if he should keep going, and God forbid he doesn't get off. So I stupidly told him to go ahead, and he did. The bar for men and sex is under hell. Hi, I'm Zahn Velines, and this is the Liberating Motherhood Podcast. Today, we are going to be talking about sex as a public political act, how our culture influences sexuality, and how sexuality influences our culture. Before we get started, as always, I have a few announcements. First, if you like this podcast, I'd like you to ask you to leave a positive review on your favorite podcast platform and to heart react it if you are listening on Substack. I know I say this every episode, and I know you're probably tired of hearing it, but these reviews and heart reacts are critical to the success of the podcast. They influence who comes on the podcast, where it appears in the algorithm and rankings, and ultimately whether it continues and at what frequency. This work is entirely free, and a quick review helps make it worthwhile to continue doing. If you really love this work, though, I hope you'll consider becoming a paid subscriber. Paid subscribers get a bonus episode each month, 8 additional essays, access to a supports group, free merch, and more. They also ensure that I never have to use advertisements, which means that no one else can ever control this work. If you're interested, subscribe at zahn.substack.com/subscribe. You can find all of the books I mentioned on the podcast at the Liberating Motherhood Bookshop page, which also hosts tons of book recommendations and reading lists. Visit the page at bookshop.org/shop/liberatingmotherhood, and that includes the wonderful book we will be discussing today by Angela Jones. Angela, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
I'm so excited to have you here. Before we get
Me
started,
too.
I'm going to tell folks a little bit about you.
Awesome.
Angela Jones is professor of women, gender, and sexuality studies at Stony Brook University. Jones's research interests include sexualities, sex work, Black feminist theory and methods, trans studies, and African American political thought and protest. They are an award-winning teacher and writer. Jones's newest trade book, Sex in Public: The Transformative Social Power of Our Erotic Lives, will be published with Seal Press/Hatchet in May 2026. So it's out now, and you should go buy it. Jones is also the author of the award-winning book, Camming: Money, Power, and Pleasure in the Sex Industry, and African American Civil Rights: Early Activism and the Niagara Movement. They are a co-author of Black Lives Matter, a reference handbook, and co-editor of Sex Work Today, Erotic Labor in the 21st Century. Jones is the editor of the award-winning reference book, African American Activism and Political Engagement, an Encyclopedia of Empowerment. Jones is also a co-editor of the 3-volume After Marriage Equality book series. Jones has also edited 2 other anthologies, The Modern African American Political Thought Reader, From David Walker to Barack Obama, and A Critical Inquiry into Queer Utopias. That's a lot of and also and also and also published so much. So I will put all of these books in the bookshop so that folks can see them and read them if they want to check out something that we're not discussing here, because there's some amazing work here.
I appreciate that very much.
So tell me a bit about this new book, why you decided to write it. how you hope it might shift the conversation, what readers can expect, all of that.
Sure. So I think my motivations for writing this book were multifaceted. I think as a social scientist, as a feminist sociologist, some of my motivations are intellectual in that I think there's a lot of psychological and physiological, biological kind of influence in terms of sexology, the systematic study of sexuality. And as a sociologist, as a feminist, I think that there's so much that we can bring to helping people understand sexuality and in a way that recognizes that sexuality is not just, again, a physiological or a biological thing, a private thing, but very much so a public matter, very much so something that is influenced by the world around us, by the institutions around us, that sexuality is inherently political, right? Not just biological and private. And so there are these intellectual motivations, but I think at the same time, I reflect a lot, and I do this in the book on my own experiences, my own sexual literacy, my own sex education. And I think, like many people, I feel like I didn't get the education that I deserved. And so, in a very personal way, there was a motivation for me to help people expand their own sexual literacy. And so, again, it's just very important for me to feel like I'm contributing to public knowledge about sexuality, not just in an academic or scientific way.
I love that. And thinking about this sex education bit, because like same, I think probably most of us can say the same. But I'm very cognizant as someone who is now raising young children, and I know you are too, of what a better approach to sex and sexuality in terms of what we teach would look like. And also what we should be learning into adulthood. Like if you could make a PSA about what we should be teaching our children and what you hope people are educating themselves about. I know that's a really broad question, but you know, it's a podcast, so you've got a lot of space to talk. So tell me.
Absolutely. Girl, I was like, we could do an entire podcast just on this question and probably still not have enough time. I love this question. I mean, I think there's ways that I would answer this in relationship to what I think schools should be doing, and in terms of what that curricula should look like in educational institutions, in very briefly in terms of offering empirically sound, clinically accurate, inclusive sex education, starting at age appropriate times, using places like Denmark and others as an example. But I think I want to maybe spend a little bit more time thinking about what this might look like in our own households and for families, because I think defaulting to schools, where especially in the US context, their young people are just not going to receive the education that they need, especially in a world, for example, saturated by sex. I think a lot about the ubiquity of pornography. And I want to be very clear, and I know you know this, I'm not somebody who is ever advocating for kind of censorship, but I think what does it look like to offer young people porn literacy so that they understand the dynamics of sex and pleasure and fantasy and power? And how do we begin to do that as parents in our own home? And I think we need to start, I think, by not thinking about sex education as just teaching the ins and outs of the ins and outs, if you will, and rather thinking about what it means to teach young people about sexuality really holistically. So one of the core interventions of the book is asking people to think about not just sex, right, but sexuality. So think about our desires, our erotic practices and behaviors, our identities, what kind of relationships we want, what kind of, kind of erotic communities we might want to be a part of. And in doing that, I think we need to teach young people about bodily autonomy, about consent. And I can say more about those things because, again, I think that for a lot of parents, it's kind of, well, teaching sex is about the birds and bees. And at some point, I'm going to sit them down and have one conversation, one and done, and that's going to be it. And I think that this is a misstep, and we should rather be thinking about an ongoing, rigorous, and opportunities to teach them about their bodies, how they work. I can give you a couple examples. So I often, and this is something I teach in my classroom. And so I'll often talk to my students, for example, about how their caregivers talk to them about their bodies, right? And we will often, even on the board, come up with this very long list. And my students will say things like the, peepees and flowers and monkeys. And believe, I've just heard some of the most wild euphemisms that people have had, as opposed to saying, well, we should be talking to young people and our children using clinical language and actually talking to them about their bodies, and in a way that doesn't necessarily promote or introduce shame, right? Even think about the language of private parts, right? And I'll often jokingly with my students kind of reenact the way that some parents will even say that, right? In this kind of sheepish voice, right? Your private parts, right? And just think about how even doing that creates this context for shame, that the body is something that you shouldn't want to talk about, or you shouldn't talk about, that it's something is the source of shame and something that you should hide. I have to think about the importance of, you want to teach people about consent. And I think in thinking about healthy erotic and sexual lives, how important bodily autonomy and consent is, and all the different ways that we could be teaching that, even if not explicitly about sex. So, for example, I've even talked with my own friends who are parents about, the smacking, for example, and I've seen this of young kids' butts, right? In a very playful way, right? What are you teaching them when you're touching their bodies? So, for example, your cousins or your aunt or grandma or whomever comes over to visit, and I see it all the time. And parents like, well, give auntie a hug and give this relative a hug or a kiss. What if they don't want to? And what are you teaching them about bodily autonomy and the control that they have over their own bodies? I mean, even anecdotally, this just came up. I was traveling with my son 2 weeks ago, and we were in an airport, and the TSA agent kind of looked to me and said, "Can I search him?" Right? I understand legally why they asked me the question, but I immediately responded and said, "I don't know. You should ask him if you can touch his body, not me." Because, and I think, and even though the agent looked at me with and scowled at me, it was important for me to role model and continue to role model to my son and reinforce to my son that I don't have control over his body. He does, not me. And I think that there are so many, maybe seemingly innocuous ways that this comes up in our daily lives with our children, where we can be reinforcing to them, reinforcing for them that they have control over their own bodies. Because again, we're instilling really important lessons about consent in the process.
Yeah, that's so I'm thinking while you're sharing this story about my children's doctor, who always before she examines them says, it's okay because I'm a doctor and because your mom's here. And then I always add, but you can also tell her no. And it's challenging because, in a way I'm having to kind of like challenge her authority. And I think a lot of times when we're having these consent conversations with kids, it forces us to challenge authority, which can be like really difficult.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think there's, and even if we're talking about bodies and mechanics, there's an entire genre of literature, I mean, broadly kind of bibliotherapy, but there are so many, I think about the Corey Silver books and others that can help provide that language if that's what some parents are searching for, right? Like they have maybe, some concerns that they don't have the language, and especially in an age-appropriate way to talk about these things. But I think we live in a world where there's lots of resources to do that. And so I think that there's a lot of onus and importance for us as parents to be talking to our children about sexuality in all of its forms, and especially about the importance of bodily autonomy and consent.
Absolutely. Well, and they're really interested in it, especially when they're little. My toddler has a pop-up vulva book that is like, it's like her favorite book, and she terrorizes guests with it. She follows them around, like opening the book and being like, "And these are the labia. I bet you don't know what the clitoris is." And I'm just like, part of me is proud, and part of me is like, okay, please, please don't let this person freak out.
Well, and sometimes they do. I'm
Yeah.
sorry, I didn't mean to. Because
Oh, no, go ahead. They
I was gonna
do.
say, and sometimes they do, because I've had these conversations where, because I only raised my son using clinical language to talk about bodies, he would use language like, scrotum or penis or whatever it was. And then there were other parents who were upset, or educators in a, kind of preschool kind of context, who were very, very, clutching their pearls and upset, and like, you're teaching inappropriate language to my children. And I'm like, wait, I'm sorry, are you telling me that clinical language about our children's bodies is inappropriate? What world are we living in?
Yeah, it's just wild, and it's just basic knowledge. But I think when you are a parent who thinks about these things and who spends time talking with other parents who think about these things, it can become very easy to become distanced from what it is like for a lot of children and a lot of families. And I'll tell you a
Yeah,
story and give you an example.
sure.
So I had my annual gynecologist exam yesterday, and I usually take some combination of my kids with me, but he didn't yesterday. And so I got in there, and they all looked a little disappointed to see me. And one of the nurses was like, "Well, where's that crazy little toddler?" And I was like, "Oh, she's at home with her dad." And then, I heard some like chitter chattering about, "Oh, she's so cute, she's so funny," in the background. And I finally asked, "Okay, like, what did she do?" Because I can't remember everything this wild child does.
Right.
And the like midwife who had done my exam the previous year was like, "Well, what I remember really clearly was when I did your exam, your toddler standing in front of the stirrups, jumping up and down and saying, 'I can't wait to see the jelly donut. Where's the cervix?'" And I started cracking up because, like, yeah, that's her. And that's kind of how I've raised my kids. But then the flip side is, I have a friend who's a very progressive sex educator and who goes to schools to teach kids kind of basic science, not even so much the consent, the ethics, all of that. Just like, here's what periods are, here's what a penis is. And she told me the story about how she was teaching at an incredibly progressive, very small school, working with seventh and eighth graders. This year, not 50 years ago, and several of the girls had gotten in the class reported they had gotten their periods without knowing what a period is. In this progressive school, their parents had not even taught them about periods. And it's mind-blowing to me. And so I think it's easy to forget that the sort of stuff that seems perhaps to you and me and to a lot of listeners, like we've heard that a million times before, is not necessarily making its way into the wider culture.
Absolutely. And I think that's so much of my experience, especially in relationship to research or even just in my friend groups, kind of bears this out, that so many people come from cultural contexts, where, and just households where sex was just not, and sexuality was not something that was talked about, and bodies were not talked about. And in a way that really thwarts our ability to not only make kind of healthy choices in our erotic lives, but ones that lead to satisfying, pleasurable, erotic lives as well.
So I want to shift a little bit more toward your book. A couple of weeks ago, I interviewed the philosopher Kate Mann on the podcast, and our whole focus was on sort of the normalization and the mainstreamization, for lack of a better word, of sexual strangulation. And so that was ostensibly the focus of the podcast. But what we really ended up talking about is how, no matter how you feel about this practice, no matter what your analysis is, no matter what you think it means, culture influences our sexuality, and our sexuality influences culture, and they reflect each other and they build upon each other. And yet we continue to have great difficulty acknowledging that reality. I think we like to think of ourselves as extremely unique beings making pure, uncorrupted choices outside of culture. And that's not really the case because we're cultural beings. So can you talk a bit about sex as a political act and maybe even politics as a sexual act?
Absolutely. And I think in some ways, I want to answer this in two ways because I was also thinking about one of the things that gets lost when we're educating young people in particular, but really everybody about sexuality is the politics of sexuality. And I've been thinking, even thinking about the vignette that you started our conversation with and sexual coercion and issues around consent, and again, how we can be better educating people around that. When it comes to the book, just the other day, and I apologize because I'm still thinking about this so much. So maybe in some ways this kind of self-serving, but this is to say, somebody was like, "Is your son's not going to read this book, right?" And I was like, "Well, yeah, my son and I have had this conversation," and I kind of tried to leave it at that in that moment. But for me, the reason why I said that was because for me, there's a lot of my kind of sexual life and sexual history in this book. And I think that some amount of boundaries between children and their parents or caregivers around the specifics of their sex lives and sexual histories, that having some boundaries around that, I think for me, feels appropriate. So, but the person was really kind of speaking to a lot of my experiences of sexual violence and sexual assault. And the person was like, you don't want him to know that those things happen to you." And while in the context of that conversation, it for reasons that I won't get into, I just left the conversation there. But I think that for me, and I realize that this is a very personal choice, but my son knowing that I have had experiences of sexual violence actually feels important for him to know for me. And I think that part of socializing our children and teaching them about sexuality means teaching them about the political realities of sexuality, and especially for people who have lived experiences of women, right? And so that, for example, part of conversations that I've already been having with my son, and that I think people could be having with and I don't want to just say their sons, but for me, I think it's especially important for young straight men to kind of understand the realities of sexual violence and what that means, right? So if you understand your job as a sexual partner is providing pleasure, to me, I would revise that and say, if you were having sex with women, I think that, your job is to create a context of safety so that she can experience pleasure, right? And communicating to your partners, whatever your sexual identity, that their consent is important to you. And so again, I just think that those political realities must be a really, really important part of how we're educating our children and just people about sexuality. And then in terms of the book and more broadly, again, I think that, yeah, I think there's this tendency to treat sexuality as a private matter, right? It's physiological, it's biological, it's somehow innate for a lot of people, as opposed to understanding it as a political force, as a social force, right? And so much of this book is about helping people to understand the way that our sexualities, and again, whether that's our desires, the behaviors, the erotic practices that we enjoy, our identities, how we label those practices, how we label the erotic or sexual communities we're a part of, the relationship structures, non-monogamy, monogamous, right? That all of these things are part of our sexuality, but they are shaped by social institutions around us, right? That if we think for a moment about our desires, it's important for people to consider how everything from the media to our families to governmental regulations, how all of the educational institutions, how all of these institutions around us and the cultures that we were raised in shaped how we even understand those things, right? When you think about desire for people who experience attraction and desire, there's often, again, this essentializing way that people talk about those desires, right? Like as if they couldn't help them. I am just attracted to fill in the blank. Right. And while I appreciate that sentiment, it's divorced from any connection to how, again, the media or any other social forces have shaped your perceptions of what you find attractive. Right. There's an entire desirability politics that is shaped by systems of power, that is shaped by heteropatriarchy and white supremacy and ableism and, and cisgenderism and so forth. And I think it's important that we pay attention to that form of social. Right, socialization. But I also think it's important that we understand the way that our sexualities and forms of eroticism also shape the world around us, right? There isn't a single institution that our sexualities don't touch. And so our sexualities and human eroticism is also this really interesting force for social change at the same time. And in so many ways, this book is really animated by all of the sexual rule breakers around the world who challenge these hegemonic systems that tell us that there are, these appropriate ways to do sexuality.
So I'm thinking while you're talking about this, I'm thinking a lot about a lot of the women who read my work, like a surprising number, are essentially political lesbians. And I think that we can debate like what that means and whether that's a problematic term and all of that. But they're essentially women who perceive themselves as heterosexual, and for probably most of their lives felt that heterosexuality was just something they were, because we make people's sexualities their identity. And then after, a certain number of experiences with men, they thought, well, I don't want anything to do with this now. And began kind of actively cultivating an attraction to women, and are now exclusively with women and often with like non-binary and gender fluid sorts of people. And it's so interesting to me because I think a lot of these women are the same women who like 20 years ago would have said, I hate that I'm attracted to men, but I am attracted to men. And, things change.
Indeed, they do. I mean, and I just want to say really quick, I think that's another thing that's really important, that the change piece that you just said, I think is really important, that sexuality is not something that's fixed. It's constantly changing. It's in flux. Our desires are constantly changing. How we might identify ourselves is often constantly changing. And I think that that's an important, and I think it's important for people to embrace that, right? That you don't have to, you don't have to stay in one particular position or identity, right? That all of these things are in flux. With respect to the political lesbians, well, I've never used this particular language. I identify in a lot of ways, right? Like, while I've always understood my sexual attraction and desires as fluid, I mean, since I'm very, very young, I think over the years I came to a place where I was like, honestly, I don't fuck with men. Like, I just really can't fuck with them. But it doesn't have to do with, for me, sex per se. It has to do with my rejection of heteropatriarchy, my desire for equity in my relationships, and my feeling that, again, that I don't want to be in any relationship that is structured by heteropatriarchy. And I'll be honest with you, over the years, my experience has been that even with men who fancy themselves incredibly progressive, men who I've met who would even identify as feminists, that because they were socialized under heteropatriarchy, that even those men, even in those relationships, heteropatriarchy was rearing its head. And I'm just not interested in that. And so it's just interesting because I identify with that a lot.
So, okay, I love that you've raised this because this gives me a chance to talk about one of my favorite axes to grind, which is that I am a queer, kind of mostly lesbian identified woman married to a man. And, and my husband is, the feminist man that like you just identified. But like a genuine one, not the like you
Good, good.
not that you can't criticize me because I'm such a feminist guy, which is like most of them are. He's a civil rights litigator and he's an equal parent, and like I'm not we're not
Love
here
it.
to praise, but we're not here to praise him for, because like
Okay.
that's the bar. Like, but he's good. I'm thrilled with my marriage, all of that. So that's kind of like the framework on which I build this. But I will say from experience, even when you are with an equal partner, even with when you are with a man who understands consent, even when you're with a man who has really unpacked his socialization and all of that, outside forces are still bringing heteropatriarchy in. And so while my husband may not actively be working to oppress me, there are plenty of other forces working really hard to get him to oppress me. And I think that's where kind of it's important to have the systems lens of, okay, well, maybe he's not a bad guy, maybe he's not abusive, maybe he's nice, whatever. But there's still a larger system that is acting on that relationship and really working hard to make our interactions and our life and our behaviors all look a certain way.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. And to be honest with you, I think that is why I have not had relationships with cis men in a very long time.
I mean, I would not do it again. I mean, I love my husband and we're extraordinarily happy together. I don't want to give the impression that like he was a mistake. But what I have learned is that there's always going to be misogyny, even if it doesn't come from a partner. And a man is always a really good path for the misogyny to make its way in. So like, as a trivial example, and it's the one people often cite, my husband does the pickup and drop off at school, and he does probably like 60% of the parenting. But guess who the school calls when they're sick?
Absolutely.
No matter how many times we tell them not to.
Absolutely. I've had this experience as well. My son's father is a cis man, and we co-parent since the time he was a very little baby. And this has always been the case for me. No matter how many times I say, please, here's an extra email. Please just add this. Or please, I am working. I am teaching all day today. Please call this number. They do not. Right. So I've 100% understand. And I think something else you said with really resonates with me, and that the bar is really low. And there are these moments where I'm like, you're giving him a cookie just for, achieving this really low bar. Oh, he's such a good dude. He doesn't cheat, and he's very respectful of you and your career, and he's very progressive. And I'm like, yeah, but that's a low bar. And I just want more than that. And just all of the different ways that, even if I think about that relationship, like you're saying, the way that other people in our lives and just in the world would constantly want to reinforce these heteropatriarchal standards or raise eyebrows. So if he was staying home with or someone who was a very little baby, it was like, oh, or people like, oh, because I didn't really take maternity leave. Like I went right back to work because those, were my economic circumstances. And it was like people judging and shaming. Why are you doing that? He should go get a second job or something. Like, why are you even still working? And I'm like, what is happening here? I just don't want this.
Isn't it wild how they are praised for the things that we are shamed for? And that's a lot of what I'm talking about. And we're getting quite a bit away from sexuality. I do think it's worth talking about. My husband and I, with our most recent child, got a really amazing comparison because in my third trimester, he had gallbladder surgery, which is like major surgery. It knocks you down and there's a recovery and there's pain and all of that. And I took wonderful, loving care of him for like the time that he was recovering. And he also continued to care for the children while he was recovering and continued to do household labor and all of that. And the texts I would get from friends about, oh God, Jeff is so wonderful that he made dinner a week after gallbladder surgery. Like, women come home from C-sections and 6 hours later are vacuuming. And so then, sure enough, I gave birth a couple of weeks later, and the roles reversed. He took great care of me. He was loving and he was parenting, and but I was also doing labor. And here again, everyone's like, "Oh God, Jeff is so wonderful. Look at how he gets up with the baby. Look at how he, I don't know, doesn't rape you in the postpartum period." Like, and it's just like, yeah, he was a good caregiver, but that's kind of the bar. And no one ever was like, "Oh, Jeff, you need to be so grateful for Zahn that she, didn't force you to vacuum and rip open your gallbladder stitches." Like, what?
The bar is so low, and I've continued to learn this throughout my parenting, even just engaging with moms just at the bus stop and listening to the conversation. And I'll never forget, it was when I were waiting at the bus stop, and one of the other moms, and they were kind of kvetching about their husbands, and one of them was just telling the story about how every morning, she has to wake up with him early when he gets up for work because she has to, find his boots for him and like
Oh my
check. chuckling. Like,
God.
I have to find his boots because, and I pack his lunch and he wouldn't be able to find his shoes without me. And they're all laughing and I'm just like, this is not funny to me.
No.
This is a fucking crisis. And this is just not a life I want. The bar is so low. And I keep thinking about that vignette that you started with and the sexual coercion that you were telling me has come up in recent themes in the podcast. And like, I'm sure that many of your listeners know this history, but thinking about marital rape, because you just said that before too, and like this is something that doesn't first become legal until 19 illegal, excuse me, until 1976 in Nebraska, and then like 1993 throughout the US. I would suggest that that is a relatively recent history, and just even de facto, even if not de jure, but de facto, this sexual coercion in heteropatriarchal marriages, in straight cis marriages in particular, just seems to be really pervasive, just in the context of the research that I've done and anecdotal conversations. And it's like, well, he does more things for me if I let him get some, or just the way that, yeah, I just, we go at it and I just, he finishes quickly. And I'm just, this is very upsetting to me to hear. And again, I think it's just this, the bar is so low. And I think that the stuff that women put up with in a lot of these relationships is really deplorable, actually.
It's so bad. And I remain convinced that the official statistics are just vastly underestimated.
Of course. Of
And I don't
course.
really know how that happens, but to me, it seems like very close to like 90 to 100% of heterosexual women have some form of coercion in their marriage and often outright rape.
Absolutely. But I don't think that they would define it in those terms,
Yeah. Well,
right?
I did a survey of my readers about a year ago and got a very large sample. It was like 4 to 5,000. And I asked them, has your current partner ever raped you? And something like 7% said yes. And then I gave a list of behaviors that would meet the legal definition of rape. Has your partner threatened to harm you if you don't have sex? Has your partner threatened self-harm if you don't have sex? Has your partner physically forced you? Has your partner made you afraid to say no? These kinds of things. And I don't remember the exact statistic, but it was well over 50% said yes. And
Yeah.
I think those two data points together really reveal a lot.
Absolutely. And I think that there's often a lot of emphasis on kind of physical coercion, and not on the really psychological forms of coercion and manipulation that I think often kind of set up those forms of sexual assault
Absolutely.
in people's relationships. And it's interesting to me because there's a moment where you said we're getting away from sexuality, but I think in some ways, this is one of the points of the book, is that I think a lot of people in, mainstream culture often kind of conflate sex and sexuality. And when we're thinking about sexuality, I think our relationships are actually a key component of our erotic lives, of our sexualities. Right. And I think that we, and I think one of the points of this book is to encourage people, hopefully to empower people, especially marginalized people, especially the women that we've just been talking about, to choose with intention the relationships that they want. That if you don't like the structure of your relationship, if you don't like the way that external systems of power, like heteropatriarchy or white supremacy, are able, if you don't like the way that any of these systems are shaping your relationships, you can resist. And there are alternative ways of organizing these relationships in ways that will feel better, that will be more profoundly empowering and pleasurable to you. And I want to be clear because I don't want to be dismissive. Believe me, especially when it comes to heteropatriarchal relationships, I understand all of the ways that external systems outside of us, our families, our communities, exert an enormous amount of pressure, and that there's forms of marginalization and stigma that can come from rebuking those norms. But there is so much empowerment and pleasure in resisting them.
Yeah, completely agree. And people so often feel that they have to like earn their way out of a relationship, like it has to be bad enough, but it's just
Yeah,
not the way.
I see this all of the time, all of the time, and even just in my own kind of personal friendships. And I'm just like, you deserve so much better.
I know, I know. Well, the thing that I always tell people is, like I draw on my own experience. I married a man and that entails a certain amount of risk. And so for me to undertake that risk, that marriage had to offer me so much in return. And like, why would I do that if I wasn't getting so much in return? Like, why?
Absolutely.
That needs to
Absolutely.
be the calculus.
Absolutely.
So I've been thinking a lot lately about sex positivity, and I'm going to try to explain my thoughts to you. They're still poorly formed, but I feel like you're the person who might help me reformulate them a little bit better.
I hope so.
So I try to identify as a sex positive feminist in all the normal things that that typically means in our movement. But I've also felt a shift in recent years, particularly in liberal white feminist spaces, toward defining sex positivity as basically like you're not allowed to interrogate, criticize, or even really like discuss any act of sexuality. Also toward like a very single-minded obsession with orgasms and away from any real radicalism, while often like saying that this is radical, that it's radical that we can't talk meaningfully about like what sex means. So the conversation feels to me like it's shifted toward this idea that all sex-related things are unquestioned goods. But I think it's more complicated than that, as our discussion reveals. I don't think that we have an ethical mandate to view sex positively or in any particular way, really, or to have like a relentlessly positive view towards sexuality. So when I was getting ready for this interview, I looked you up and looked up sex positivity to see what you had said. And I found this great paper you wrote in 2022, and you defined sex positivity so simply as the political act of defining your sexuality on your own terms.
Yes.
And I was just like, that's so beautiful. And that is so different from what I have been told and from the kinds of conversations I have about this. Can you talk to me a little bit about this and help me understand like what's going wrong in sex positive communities, or at least communities that label themselves sex positive with these discussions?
Indeed, I can, and with much enthusiasm and joy. I think, and I would also include here the word empowerment. Both the language of sex positivity and empowerment yawn. And I think to the point where sometimes I even roll my eyes because I think they've become these hollow buzzwords divorced from any critical lens in the way that you're describing. So for me, sex positivity in particular has become so much about the freedom to fuck, right? So that reducing it in the way that you were just talking about to orgasms. So there's this really wonderful piece by Brianne Foss where she talks about feminist Brianne Foss, where she talks about the differences in distinguishing between the freedom to and freedom from. And what that means is so much of mainstream sex positive discourse is really told through the lens of freedom too. So you're being sex positive if you're out there having lots of sex and lots of orgasms. And it's just really reducing sex positivity to your freedom to have all of the sex you want in the world, which to which I would also add, this is also reinforcing what we call compulsory sexuality, because there's, you should then also add the freedom to not want to have sex at all. But what really gets lost in so much of that mainstream discourse is the freedom from that we need to add to that conversation. The freedom from heteropatriarchal violence, the freedom from white supremacist violence, the freedom from all of these oppressive structures, and the way that, any of the, for example, sexual violence that people face stems from these systems. It's not just about bad men or bad people. It's about the systems that empower those individuals to behave in the way that they are. So I think that for me is what gets lost in a lot of the mainstream sex positive discourse.
Yeah, that's really helpful. It feels like we have to have freedom from these forces before we can even really talk about empowerment. Because how can you even really make an empowered choice when it might not be safe to make another choice.
Absolutely. And what is it that people mean when they say empowering anyway? I mean, for me, and Koa Beck talks about this so well in her book when she's critiquing white liberal feminism and talking about the way that when people think about empowerment, it's like everything is empowering and you're a kind of boss bitch feminist and you're empowered. And I think it's divorced from political systems, right? That for me, empowerment stems from resisting political structures. And it is very much for me an embodied or corporeal experience, right? It's not something that some snake oil salesman is selling me, right? Like there's all of these discourses that if only you have the right sex toys or you go to the right sex class or you've consumed the right sex product, you can be sexually empowered. And it's totally divorced from politics, right? And from what happens for us when we are resisting and challenging systems of power, that for me, that is the loci or the locus of empowerment.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're low on time. So I want to ask you kind of one final big question that
Ooh.
I don't have an answer to. I don't have
Okay.
any theories about this. I have no idea what to think of this or like what you're going to say. I have written so many times that really one of the very few subjects that I write about, and I write about a lot of stuff that's really controversial, but the only one that really consistently gets me death threats, angry emails, people saying, you've betrayed me and you're not who I thought you were, is anything I write about sexuality at all.
Yeah.
Somehow I am simultaneously too anti-sex work and too pro-sex work, too anti-kink and too pro-kink, too anti-porn and too pro-porn. Write about any of these things and everybody suddenly hates you. And it's very difficult to like come together and to have meaningful disagreements, to say, okay, you think pornography is harmful. I agree to some extent, but let's look at what happens when we ban it. And could we come up with before you can even finish the sentence, people are refusing to talk to one another.
Absolutely.
What is this? Why is this happening?
This is such a great question and something that I experience all of the time. And especially, as you know, since a lot of my research and advocacy work has been around sex work and sexual commerce, this is something that I experience all of the time from people on the internet to legislators that I work with in the kind of some of the policy work that I do. And it's these really knee-jerk reactions that I think are rooted in what sex workers call whorephobia, which is institutionalized hatred and stigma and discrimination against sex workers, and its entanglements with heteropatriarchy, right? And so I think that, and I also think that there are these people are often raised in these cultures around sex that tell them that sex is relational. It is, even if you're somebody who doesn't understand sex as sacred, that for many people, it is still something that is profoundly relational, should be done in the context of a relationship. Even for people who would say, oh, it doesn't have to be a married relationship, but it should still be relational. And so there's still this thinking of sex as something that is kind of sacred and relational, and that it is not something that should be used for commerce or for work, which I obviously think is a misguided perception. And I think it's so interesting. You're reminding me of some of the policy work that I've done where I have sat in rooms with legislators and have done presentations, have written scientific memos for a number of legislatures that are considering bills to decriminalize sex work. And all of the social science, I mean, decades of international social science unequivocally supports the decriminalization of the consensual exchange of sex. And because it promotes positive public health outcomes, has effects in decreasing trafficking, right? There's just so many positive outcomes through that legislation, and the science supports that. But every time it seems like you get this knee-jerk reaction from legislators that we talk to, where it's like they're still resting on this idea that it is sacred. And I think in a lot of those conversations, what's also again becomes apparent to me is that so much of this is also heteropatriarchal, right? This, we are going to save women, although again, keep in mind there's a very significant diversity of people across the gender spectrum who work in sex industries, not just women. But there's this thinking that we need to save women from these industries rather than thinking about ways to improve any labor exploitation that may exist in those industries. And those industries aren't inherently more exploitative than any capitalist industry, right? So if you're concerned about exploitation and sexual commerce, you should be concerned about exploitation in all capitalist industries, and in my opinion, treated as such. And I think one of the things that I talk about specifically in the conclusion of the book is this knee-jerk reaction towards prohibition, as opposed to thinking about these issues through the lens of harm reduction. I would never argue that exploitation doesn't exist in sex industries. Of course it does, the same way it does in any capitalist industry. But we need to be thinking about how to make that industry safer for all of the people who work in it, the same way we have done. If you look at the decriminalization of marijuana, if you look at gambling industries, right? Like, the approach through harm reduction always leads to better outcomes than outright prohibition. And this knee-jerk reaction and tendency towards prohibition is something that I too often have a hard time wrapping my head around. And the amount of kind of bad faith arguments that I get from people, or conversations that I have with people, that no matter how much scientific evidence, no matter how much sex workers, for example, provide their own testimony and own stories, people are basically gaslighting them and telling them, no, right? What you're saying doesn't matter, right? Because we need to stop this. And like you, I sometimes have a really hard time wrapping my head around why.
Yeah, just the why. So, what I would say to listeners listening to this who think that Angela or I or both of us are wrong about something is engage with us. Like, post a comment that actually meets us where we are rather than making a straw person argument or, attacking us as bad feminists. And, like, convince me, tell me where I'm wrong, tell me what I'm getting wrong, and, like, let's talk about it. We need to be able to talk to each other because that's the only way we can build meaningful solidarity.
Absolutely. And I think when it comes to sex work, the other thing that I would recommend, and I am always happy to share resources with people. In fact, a couple of us created an entire syllabus of sex worker written writing, media resources, because I think there's a lot of people talking for sex workers in the public sphere, as opposed to people actually listening to what sex workers are saying. So if sex workers all over the world are saying that decriminalization is the policy that they want, or that these are their experiences, why are people not inclined to listen to what the very people who are impacted by that legislation are saying?
Well, and it's because it's born of paternalism and the idea that, well, they don't really know what's best for themselves because they're
Right.
somehow less human or less smart or less thoughtful than the person who's never even been in the industry.
Right. And how dehumanizing is that?
Totally. I mean, it is the definition of dehumanization.
Absolutely.
So I want to encourage everyone to please go out and buy Angela's book, which is amazing.
Thank you.
It's out now. It's so good. It covers so much ground and it covers so many of the kinds of discussions that we are all having. So buy it for that reason. Buy it also because you want publishers to publish more books like it. We live in a capitalist society, whether you like it or not, and supporting this kind of work tells publishers that the next Angela who comes along also deserves support and also deserves publication and just helps us get more diversity in media. So I hope you will buy it, like it, review it, and tell us what you think.
Love that. Thank you.
Angela, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been just great having you.
My pleasure.
And I'll put all of Angela's information in the show notes. They've published so much interesting stuff, so I'll try to provide some links. But if there's something that we've mentioned that's not in the show notes, feel free to leave a comment and one of us will try to get it to you. And Thank you so much for listening, and I will be back in 2 weeks.